This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The work of Native American author and Methodist preacher William Apis went largely unnoticed from his death in 1839 until the 1970s. That's when historians started to compile his writings, and they turned out to be quite a collection of eloquent work that described the dynamics between Native Americans and white Americans in the 19th century. They also show a man who was searching for his own identity as an American with both Pequot and white ancestry. A new biography called The Life of William Apis, Pequot, traces that search. And here to talk about the life of William Apis is author Philip Gurup, professor of American literature at UNC Chapel Hill. Welcome back, Phil. Good to have
Thank you,
here.
Frank. Always a pleasure to be here.
So tell us about this. We should probably start a little bit of the backstory, William Apis' heritage, where he came from.
Well, the Pequot tribe is a very interesting case. Supposedly, they had been exterminated in the 1630s. Puritans waged a very severe war against them. And any survivors were put out among other tribes, and they were not supposed to use that identity. But they actually were able to persist as a group and eventually moved back to lands in southern Connecticut. So the Pequot tribe was given certain lands by the colony where they were able to, again, reconstitute their heritage for the future. And Apis's family came from that group in southern Connecticut.
Speaking the Pequot tongue was punishable by death after
that. Right. That's right. And one of the great mysteries in his autobiography, which he published first in 1829, he says very little about his folkways. We know very little about how much Native American life he preserved because the biography really is tracing his conversion to Methodism. But it's fascinating to consider that evidently the Pequot language was still spoken among some of those people. And when he gave one of his famous addresses, he actually ended it by reciting the Lord's Prayer in the Massachusetts language, which is the larger language group these people spoke. So we puzzle over whether or not he actually knew the language or simply had memorized this from some tract that he had.
Keeping your distance from Pequot traditions, given the fact that at one point speaking the language made you death eligible, as they say in legislative parlance. It's not surprising that he would run away. His grandmother did. He received a terrible beating from his grandmother.
His parents moved away at an early age, and when he was at an early age, and left him with grandparents who very severely treated him. Excuse me. So that he had to be taken in as a ward of the town. Let me just give you an example of how he talks about this very frightening time. Our parents quarreled, parted, and went off to a great distance, leaving their helpless children to the care of their grandparents. We lived at this time in an old house divided into two apartments, one of which was occupied by my uncle. Shortly after my father left, my grandmother, who had been out among the whites, returned in a state of intoxication, and without any provocation whatever on my part, began to belabor me most unmercifully with a club. She asked me if I hated her, and I very innocently answered in the affirmative, as I did not know what the word meant, and thought all the while I was answering properly. And so she continued asking me the same question, and as I often answered her in the same way, whereupon she continued to beat me. I was then only 4 years of age, and consequently could not take care of or defend myself, and I was equally unable to seek safety in flight. But my uncle, who lived in the other part of the house, being alarmed for my safety, took me away when my grandfather came at me with a firebrand. He had not come at me at the time again, I would most certainly have been killed. He was taught to hate his identity. He was taught to hate being a Native American, and then for the next several years was put out among white families.
This is not surprising given what we know about the psychology of this kind of racism, but the fact that we have a 19th century witness who has written an autobiography and we have this kind of first-person testimony is what is one of the remarkable things about William Apis.
That's right. It was the first Native American autobiography to be published in 1829. He revised it slightly in 1831. As I said a moment ago, it's unfortunate that he does not dwell more on his Pequot heritage. It takes the form of what you might term a conversion narrative. He talks about how he had fallen into sin, how he had finally fallen into despair, and then eventually found that the gospel gave him some kind of solace. So there's no denying that his discovery of Christianity was a great part of what made him what he was later. So you can't deny that he was influenced greatly by white civilization, but he was able to use the language of the Bible to turn certain kinds of causes against the whites who had treated him so poorly.
Yeah, talk about that, because he became a Methodist minister.
That's
and
right.
Very definitely read the Gospels differently than his
that's
white
right.
counterparts.
The Methodists were known for an appeal to the lower classes, to people of color, particularly in the later 18th and early 19th century. And Apis, through one of his white families, found this particular kind of preaching very moving to him. And he insisted that if one read the Gospels properly, color should not be an issue for someone. Let me just give you an example of how powerfully he could use this kind of rhetoric. He wrote at one point, "I acknowledge this is a confused world, and I am not seeking for office, but merely placing before you the black inconsistency that you place before me. Let me exhort you to do away with these principles. It appears 10 times worse in the sight of God and candid men than skins of color, more disgraceful than all the skins that Jehovah ever made. If black or red skins or any other skin of color is disgraceful, it appears God has disgraced himself a great deal, for he has made 15 colored people to every white when he placed them here on earth. Let me ask you, white man, if it is a disgrace for to eat, drink, and sleep with the image of God, or sit or walk and talk with them? Or have you the folly to think that the white man, being 1 in 15, are the only beloved images of God? Assemble all the nations together in your imagination. Let the whites be seated among them. Then let us look for the whites, and I doubt not it would be hard finding them, for to the rest of the nations they are still but a handful. Now suppose these skins were put together, and each skin had its national crimes written upon it. Which skin do you think would have been the greatest?"
Author Philip Gurrow reading from the autobiography of William Apis. It's called The Life of William Apis, Pequot. So again, we're getting a kind of a preview of what will be a template for civil rights activity in the United States, an appeal to both civic justice and religious and moral justice.
Yeah, one of the fascinating things is just how he conceived his identity and how he found his way toward this larger criticism. As I indicated a few moments ago, he really is raised in white culture by these foster families, but he never forgets his Pequot heritage. Often when he runs away, and he ran away from his parents several times, foster parents, he finds his way back to the Pequot tribe. He wants to remain among his people. So his first identity seems to come from that nation, the Pequot group. But then, through other experiences, for example, he fought in the War of 1812. He traveled in upstate New York and southern Canada. He met people, particularly of the Mohawk tribes. He began to understand that people of color in different areas experienced the same kind of prejudice. Then he moved to the Boston area and met abolitionists who were preaching for the black cause, and that rhetoric began to influence him. So that by the time he becomes a mature reformer, he really has incorporated these criticisms from a wide variety of groups and is able to turn what had been a very a small criticism just of the way his tribe was treated to the treatment of natives as a whole in the nation.
You make a very interesting point in the book, too. You talked about his foster parents, but he had a unique situation in that he was able to apprentice in one of these homes, which made it unlike foster parentage of the time, and perhaps is something that in a way propelled him or at least saved him from
apprenticing would be a generous word. My sense is that a formal apprenticeship actually is a document that insists that you be given certain kinds of care and privileges and learn a certain craft. He really was essentially a person who was another hired hand in the family. So again, I think the more important thing is to realize that while he was among these white people, he was able, even in the face of their criticism of other natives, to maintain his identity. There's one haunting passage in the book where he's walking with his white foster parents and sees some people who are dark-skinned. He's terrified. He runs home because he's been taught that people who are natives could be very cruel to one. So through that kind of hatred, he has to find his own identity still and is able to by the time he's in his middle and late teens.
Doesn't have much in the way of formal education, and yet he is a skilled orator and a writer. He writes something called The Eulogy of King Philip. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about his writing, his intellectual
life. Let's start with that, with the education. He had 5 or 6 years of schooling in a small town in Connecticut at a colored school that the town had been forward-looking enough to have a school for children of ex-slaves and Native Americans as well. The word colored referred to people of color, of mixed race, African American, Native American. The census had one category white, the other category colored, so he fell into that. 5 or 6 years of what you might term elementary school. And then where does he get this ability to write so powerfully? I suspect it came from his reading and study of the Bible. I think the rhetoric that he found there propelled him into the kind of criticisms he was able to make later on. By the 1830s, when he gives his eulogy on King Philip, he really has achieved a very powerful voice, and he indicts the nation for what we later might term its manifest destiny, the sense that the white race had the right to sort of spread out throughout the whole country and remove the Indian tribes.
Yeah, and we should just point out, King Philip, not a European figure, the nom de guerre to an Indian, a Native American who led a rebellion.
In the 1670s, and seen by most white Americans as someone who had to be conquered. He finally was captured and actually beheaded when King Philip's War ended in 1677. Apis insisted that he should be regarded the equal of any patriot in the country, equal to George Washington, equal to Patrick Henry, equal to these sorts of people. He wanted to revise American history to bring in the voices and the actions of his own people.
You have something maybe you can read from that eulogy for us to give us a sense of the rhetoric.
How deep, then, was the thought of Philip when he could look from Maine to Georgia and from the ocean to the lakes and view with one look all his brethren withering before the more enlightened to come? And how true his prophecy that the white people would not only cut down their groves but would enslave them. Had the inspiration of Isaiah been there, he could not have been more correct. Our groves and hunting grounds are gone, our dead are dug up, our council fires are put out, and a foundation was laid in the first legislature to enslave our people. Look at the disgraceful laws disenfranchising us as citizens. Look at the treaties made by Congress, all broken. Look at the deep-rooted plans laid when a territory becomes a state, that after so many years the laws shall be extended over the Indians that live within their boundaries. Yea, every charter that has been given was given with the view of driving the Indians out of these states, or dooming them to become chained under desperate laws that would make them drag out a miserable life as one chained to the galley. And this is the course that has been pursued for nearly 200 years.
Well, this really puts us in mind of Frederick Douglass's famous Independence Day speech, doesn't it?
Indeed. And when I began this book, I thought that I wanted to make Apis the equal of Douglass, to bring him to the attention of Americans, not just the Native Americans for their heritage, but of all Americans. But then there is an interesting distinction. What Douglass wanted was the extension of citizenship laws to African Americans. That is, he wanted the same kinds of privileges as whites. Apis was really fighting more for the privilege of those independent Native nations to remain independent and to control their own lands. He was involved in a very complex case with the state of Massachusetts, in which he represented the Mashpee tribe on Cape Cod. They didn't want to vote in national elections. They didn't want to do anything more than control their lands and elect their own people who were working in that area.
Who was listening to Apis? Who was reading him? And who was following? I mean, there's an interesting, you've got this clip from a newspaper. In the paper it says, a eulogy will be pronounced on this truly noble son of the forest, referring to King Philip, by an Indian preacher who well understands the history. I'm surprised that the white newspaper gave him credit for that.
Well, his first entree into that world of the newspaper publishers was through William Lloyd Garrison and his famous paper, The Liberator. When Apis began preaching in Boston in the early 1830s, Garrison noted his speeches. He told you where you could hear Apis. He told you what he was saying in previously issued sermons. So it's clear that the abolitionists found his voice very compelling. So I think it's through that kind of publicity that he begins to get this larger following. Who's listening to him? Well, he packed lecture halls when he delivered his eulogy on King Philip. The lecture hall held almost 1,000 people. He was asked to repeat it within 2 weeks. He repeated it again in several towns and cities in New England. So he was establishing a reputation as someone who was representing Native peoples at the same time that the nation was obsessed with the problems over the Cherokee in the southeastern states. He knew that. He made reference to it. He told people in Massachusetts, you know, you're so concerned about the southern tribes. Look at what you're doing to people right here on Cape Cod in the Mashpee
reservation. A reputation that didn't always serve him well among his fellow Methodists. He ran afoul of their rules of order now and then.
Yes, he had trouble getting ordained. The Methodist Episcopal Church had begun, as I mentioned earlier, as a place where people of lower classes were particularly welcome, but it had achieved a certain kind of stability, a certain kind of maturity by the late 1820s, and every time he applied to become a circuit preacher for them, they held him up on some grounds. Many of them seem rather specious. So he actually joined a splinter group, the Protestant Methodist Church, which had begun in New York and still was making a particular effort to reach people of color as well as those of lower classes. He became a circuit preacher, moving throughout New England, Cape Cod in particular, and even in the southern Hudson River Valley. So he really becomes an established minister who is moving to different communities, preaching presumably on scriptural topics, but also offering in these occasional lectures this kind of criticism of Native American treatment.
His death seemed to attract at least as much attention as his life. How did he die?
Well, it was a very sad case. After the Mashpee won their case against Massachusetts, they were given the privilege to organize and run their own community. For some reason, which isn't particularly clear, he ran afoul of his friends on Cape Cod, fell into debt, had to mortgage all of his goods, and finally moves down to Manhattan, where he tries to make a living lecturing on topics regarding Native American history and culture. But throughout his life, he says this very openly in his autobiography, throughout his life he had struggled with alcohol. And toward the end of his life, I guess, because of his indebtedness, because of his inability to garner the kind of crowds he had had earlier, he fell back into serious drinking and finally died in Lower Manhattan in a boarding house of what the coroner called apoplexy, probably what we would call a stroke. But the coroner also indicated that neighbors said he had been on a frolic all week, meaning that he had been probably drinking and coming home inebriated. So a person who really, in his early 40s, was only beginning to find his stride, and yet for some reason not being able to make it in that metropolis.
How is it that he fell out of consciousness for so long, and what attracted him to you?
Well, his works all were published in very small editions. These are very rare books. He wasn't rediscovered really until the 1970s as we in literature and history began looking back to people of color, to women, to writers who had been neglected. So it was people really who realized that that there was a kind of power of rhetoric here that, as you said earlier, was the equal of someone like Frederick Douglass. So he began to get notice from people doing Native American history. And finally in the 1990s, Barry O'Connell, a scholar at Amherst College, published his complete works so that they're now readily available for us. Anyone can get these in any decent-sized library. And I really was he was brought to my attention by students who began to read widely in early American literature and thought that he should become part of their dissertations. And eventually these students went on to publish very important work on him.
You know, a fascinating footnote in all this, we talked about his formal education and the fact that he died in debt. The fact that he was sued so often and was in debt meant that there's a record of his of everything he owned, and that was enlightening as well.
Importantly, when one thinks how one traces the life of this person, there were some public records, as you indicate. And at one point, he mortgaged all of his property, and the document actually lists every object that he had in his home. So we literally have an account of how many chairs he owned, how many sheets, how many spoons, and such. But more importantly, he lists every book in his library. And as far as I can tell, this is the first documentation we have of what kind of library a Native American minister would have. In a sense, some of these things are very predictable. They have to do with the kind of theology he was representing. But even to understand that a person in such poor circumstances as he could amass a library of almost 100 books is very significant. He really emerges as the first Native American intellectual that we have in this country and has to be remembered for that reason.
It's a fascinating story and extremely well told, Phil, I have to say. But what do we know? What does it change anything about what we know about Native American history in knowing more about William Apis?
Well, it is, as I just said, it is the earliest voice. It is a voice that realizes not only that the Native American cause has to be brought to the public, but also that the Native American cause has links to the other great project of that time, that is the abolition of slavery, so that you really have someone who is emerging in the 1830s as a very serious critic of American democracy and saying that we simply are not living according to the principles that we had set out in the Constitution.
Phil, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Frank.
Philip Gura, professor of American literature at UNC Chapel Hill, the author of the biography, The Life of William Apis Pequot. Just ahead, a new documentary about African-American tennis legend Althea Gibson. Stay tuned.